Good morning. The first part of Playback this week is brought to you by the letter B, bombs and budget booms. This was Clare's opening on Tuesday.
Israeli troops this morning crossed into southern Lebanon to begin what it's called a limited, localised and targeted ground operation following 2 weeks of airstrikes. Lebanese residents have been warned by an Israeli military spokesperson against moving their vehicles while heavy fighting takes place.
The chaos continued on Morning Ireland on Wednesday.
CNN was on air from Tel Aviv when the attack happened.
Sirens are going off, which has not occurred here for really today, certainly, or the last several days. They're quite extensive sirens. You hear them all over Tel Aviv right now. That was a rather large explosion.
Oh, Jesus. Oh, God. Okay, guys, we got to get off the roof. These are coming down right next to us here.
Please do, Jim. Please do.
The situation is, of course, taking its toll on Lebanese people living and working in Ireland. This from Shifra Mulqueen on The Business.
It's more difficult when you're far away from the problem. You know, you see, I'm physically here, but my heart is still in Lebanon and thinking about Lebanon all the time. Constantly I listen to the news, first thing in the morning, last thing at night.
Michelle Ayew is the owner of Sandyford Motors in Dublin.
They send text messages to the population in South Lebanon, leave in 2 hours, we're going to start bombing. Totally disappeared, the whole family in the cars, boom, they're gone. I have to stop myself watching the news. It hurts so much, yes. I go silent, I just look at it, and then many times I think about that pilot who dropped these bombs. How does he sleep at night?
Same of our neighbor in the south, on the way I rang him, he said his house is damaged, our house is damaged.
Abed and Fatima Sarhan run the Cedar Tree Lebanese restaurant in Dublin. Minutes before we speak, they got news from a neighbour that their home in South Lebanon was damaged by a bomb.
I just got the photo now of the house next door to our house. The road to our house, the destruction is...
Everything's gone.
Like, yeah. Oh my God. That's the first images we got from our village. Oh my God.
I'm here, I'm with you.
On Morning Ireland yesterday, RTE's Fran McNulty brought us up to date.
We're pushing way beyond the UN-imposed buffer zone that is there. Israel is warning people well beyond that they need to evacuate. Their plan looks like they're going to push further north to create their own buffer zone, as they might say. The Israeli claim is that what they're doing is taking out launch spots for rockets, because a barrage of rockets has been fired towards North Israel over the past couple of days. One other operation that happened overnight as well, the main border crossing between Beirut and Damascus was hit last night. Tens upon tens of thousands of people have crossed that border crossing to get out of Lebanon, and what Israel is saying is it's being used to bring in weapons, so they had to take it out.
So many people in Lebanon who make up the population had already fled from other parts of the Middle East. For those who are trying to get out of the country, can they?
It's really difficult, Gavin. There's one airline landing and taking off consistently. The other thing that's happening is, even this morning, in the past 15 minutes, I have seen three planes that are not commercial aircraft, one military, one large chartered plane and one private jet land. And we know that in the early hours of this morning, there are reports that the Iranian foreign minister landed in Beirut. There was a plane with an Iranian flag seen landing at the airport. It's thought that he has come into town to express sympathy for the death of Hassan Nasrallah, and then also speculation that this symbolic funeral that could take place, that he will be here for that.
Also on Morning Ireland, and indeed listening to Fran's report, former President Mary Robinson.
Oh, it's very worrying, Anya. It's vital that all parties de-escalate and recognise that military aggression and retaliatory attacks can't solve this conflict.
Who can change their course?
This bad right-wing government of Israel has decided it can now aggressively attack. It has... overreacted in relation to Gaza and decimated Gaza with not just 42,000 killed, but think of the injuries, particularly to children. What we need is to tone down and see that retaliatory attacks may lead to a total war, which would be disastrous, because it could be a forever war for poor Israel and Israel's citizens. you know, the cynicism that I encountered in New York from foreign ministers of the Middle East. I was at a dinner that the Taoiseach that was also at. You know, they were so cynical about, you know, the West talks about human rights and international humanitarian law. Forget it. You know, and this is very bad for the world as well. But it's the toll of civilian deaths, particularly of women and children, that is so appalling.
And again, the Israeli government, they've not been listening to the United Nations. They've banned UN Chief Antonio Guterres from entering Israel. After your remarks this morning, Mary Robinson, you'll hardly be welcome in Israel now, will you?
I would be very sorry if my remarks are seen in any way as being anti-Israel. The elders absolutely agree with Israel's right to defend itself, right to live in the as a state in peace in the region. That's what we've always championed. There is a disproportionate aggressive response by Israel at the moment, and that needs to be reined in and could be reined in by stopping supplying the weapons. You know, I wish for the Israeli people that they have a better future than this government is leading them to, where they're becoming a pariah state. This could be a forever war for them. This shouldn't be, you know, necessary. Those attacks of the 7th of October did cause great trauma. We've talked to hostages' families, but the response of this government is leading Israel into a horrible position in the world. And I fear for that. I am far from, I've never been anti-Semitic, never would be, never could be, and nor any of the elders.
Former President of Ireland, Mary Robinson there, and before her, Fran McNulty of RTE, reporting from the Middle East. Well, you're not dealing with muck on Morning Ireland, because yesterday they had not one but two former presidents. Mary McAleese paid tribute to her friend, the late Mary O'Rourke.
There I was in my bath this morning with the radio on when the 7 o'clock news came on, and that's the very first I heard of it, because I was coming in to meet Brian Joyce at 8 o'clock this morning, and I was getting myself ready and to come in to have the meeting with them, and this is what I heard on the radio.
Here's Mary McAleese.
Although she was a leading light and politically, not just for women, but a leading light politically generally, she had a great capacity for friendship, for kindness. That's what I most remember about her, was her easy way of kindness. She was the first person I approached, the first politician I approached when I thought of standing for the presidency back in 1997. Martin and I went down to Athlone to her very modest home. She was so full of encouragement. And of course, the first thing she did was she said, "We'll put the kettle on, we'll have a cup of tea," which meant, of course, that Enda went into the kitchen and made the tea while Mary and I chatted. And there was a great love in that house. Oh, it was a lovely home to visit, because there was such a just happy, joyful place. She had been at the height of ministerial achievement, and then, of course, was demoted, had to take that on the chin. She said afterwards she was devastated, but if she was, she never let that show publicly. And on she went and kept on working.
Tuesday was Budget Day, and the chorus of approval was deafening. However, leaving the VAT rate on hospitality at 9% did not go down well with the Restaurant Association. Here's Adrian Cummins on Drive Time.
Well, our industry is reeling from the news today that we got basically nothing. We've had three high-level meetings with government. At no stage did they say that we were not getting the 9% VAT rate. What we're seeing now is many, many businesses, after listening to the news today, deciding whether they're going to continue in business, and what those closure rates will continue. The consequence is that the cost of business at the moment is still going up. The minimum wage increase of 80 cents, there'll be a knock-on effect for that through wage inflation. Our staff must be paid. There's a shortage of housing in the country, and that's why wage inflation is going up and up. But on the other side, the government had a prime opportunity here to look at the hospitality industry, which is one of the most hardest hit in terms of closures, and to bring that VAT rate from 13.5% down to 9%. And if they don't do something on a support package for us, you'll see much, much more closures.
Even the dismal scientists couldn't really give out too much about it until Thursday's Morning Ireland. Seamus Coffey of the Fiscal Advisory Council.
These things are called one-off, but now they've happened for 3 years in a row. And when introduced, and particularly when introduced for low-income families, should be repeated again next year. So we should be considering these to be permanent, not these one-off measures. And too many of them are universal. They're untargeted, such as the energy credit. We're close to just over 2 million households. Announcing a €250 energy credit for that number of households is spending €500 million. So yes, absolutely, the government should be responding to the increased inflation we've seen recently, but it should be doing sort of on a more permanent basis, particularly for low-income households.
And some of those low-income households were ignored in the budget. I'm talking about the means test for carers.
It's not only means tested, it's taxable. Then, I mean, when you reach a certain age where you should really be, you know, getting care yourself.
How much work can you do without being hit again on the carer's allowance, Gillian?
The most you can work is 18.5 hours a week. I can't go into employment for somebody who would say, I don't worry about it. If you work 20 hours this week and you work 16 the next, it'll all even out in the wash. No, no, no. It's 18.5 per week. And if I worked 19 hours a week, I would lose my carer's allowance entirely. So I'm providing care in other people's houses as well as my own. So, and I am in the position that I have to constantly watch and be careful, because I'm terrified if I went over by half an hour, I could lose my carer's allowance the next week.
Hang on. Two of your adult children are disabled, and you go out and work as a carer in another person's home, and you're doing that to get money to help pay for caring for your two disabled adult children.
That's exactly what I'm telling you. I trained as a physical therapist. I've gone away. I've got my education. I've done all of that. But I can't be a reliable employee, because I have to be able to move at a moment's notice if my son needs me.
That's Gillian there speaking to Joe with one of those stories that gets lost in the middle of the millions and billions.
I was getting half carers.
Okay.
Up to May, I got a letter to say, because my husband works, I would be getting cut to €40 a week.
Oh my God.
Shannon at home, she's living with us for the last 24 years.
Yeah.
My husband works.
Yeah.
And he comes home from work and it's another job. She has spastic cerebral palsy.
Okay.
She's chronic lung disease. She's scoliosis. She's blind. She's PEG fed. She's on oxygen. We're at a handing out 24,000 in the last 2 years on a lift, not a stair lift, because we need a floor lift for Shannon.
Yeah.
They contacted me in May when Shannon was in the matter very sick,
yeah,
to say my husband had to send in his pay slips and bank statements. And then I got the letter there 2 weeks ago to say, yeah, that we're over the limit.
Yeah.
I will be getting cut from €124 to €40 a week.
Now that is beyond shocking.
That's Angela there speaking to Joe. Natalie's dad looks after her mum.
My dad has never been able to avail of the carer's allowance.
Okay.
So he's been caring for my mum since 2002 and gets no help from the state.
I presume he's tried.
Oh, he's tried. He actually only received a letter yesterday to say he'd been refused again. So that's going to go back to appeal. Since 2002, Mum had her stroke in 2002, and that was,
wow,
quite a big stroke. So that was life-changing. And he became a carer then, and 15 years ago, she had a massive brain hemorrhage. And he does an absolutely amazing job, as do all home carers. It's Trojan work that they do.
Yeah.
And finally, Mary, who summed up the mood of anybody who had stuck with Liveline for the previous half-dozen or so callers.
Depressed, listening to all this.
Did the budget make any difference to you, this bonanza jackpot
Not the slightest bit.
You're a full-time carer.
I'm a full-time carer, yes, for my daughter. I have been for 47 years. I also work as a part-time home help for the HSE. But I was getting the carer's allowance up to COVID, when COVID came in.
Okay.
Like I work as a home help.
Yeah, okay.
So when it was over, then they got back to their office down there in Longford in the Department of Social Protection. So they sent me out a bill for the 2 years, 20 and 21, of carer's allowance back, and I got billed for it. And they cut me off for carer's allowance as well. I just can't describe how bad the successive governments have been to carers.
Are they still pursuing you for that?
I refuse to pay it.
Tens of thousands of family carers around the country ably represented on Liveline during the week. But fear not, at least the nation's children will have pouches for their phones. This came up on the late debate on Wednesday night.
There's 166 pouches could be deployed to stop people going on their phones during business.
I don't know what we do, Danny. I don't know what we do, Danny. He raised his phone. We'd have to get a steel cage for concrete.
He's not here to defend himself. Well, he knows a thing or two about construction. Maybe he could build that concrete case himself.
He sure does. But no, look, again, that principal from Cal or wherever rang it, he did right. These things aren't discussed at all. So you're turning the teachers into police people now.
Matty McGrath there on Wednesday's late debate, extending the job specs of the nation's teachers. Back in a bit. Welcome back. With Oliver on Monday, Geoffrey Archer.
It's fashion, isn't it? If you're a storyteller, if you're a Shanachie, as you call in your great country, you're not treated on the same level. I've won awards, can you hold your breath, in France, Germany, Finland, Sweden and America. I've never won an award in Britain.
His point being that it's very rare for a prize shortlist to coincide with the bestsellers.
I saw a book the other day that they were giving some wonderful prize for, so I thought I'd look it up in the bestsellers list. It was number 2,749. Okay. And I just thought, give up, Geoffrey. Would I rather be 2,749 and have a literary award? No, thank you very much. I prefer to have millions of readers, and I'm very grateful to them because they stop me in the street and say, we can't wait for the next one, Geoffrey, which is good enough for me.
And here's a plot twist. Archer and his then new wife, Mary, honeymooned in Ireland.
We started in Dublin, went Killarney, Blarney, Limerick, back to Dublin. I love the people and I love the country. So we had our honeymoon there. You're all mad, of course. You're completely bonkers.
Nice messages teamed in, including this.
Thank you for getting me back to reading.
That's very kind. I'm always touched by people who... I get a lot of mothers write to me saying their children started on Not a Penny More, Not a Penny Less, and got them into reading. And that is always a pleasure for any author.
We come back to books and libraries in a few minutes. But later in the week, another guest of Oliver's, Ben Elton.
I'm against the Tories. I tell people where I vote, but that's not my act. I mean, I've got friends who are Tories. I mean, you know, if they're starting to pivot towards Nigel Farage, then maybe we won't be having dinner anymore. But politics is part of all our lives because it's the jobs and services on which we depend, and it's the environment which we have custody over. And so I think everybody should be interested in a little bit of politics. And of course, I use it to feed my work a bit. But basically, I'm there to deliver 2 hours of hilarious comedy. I think I've done it in the past, and I'm prepared to promise I'll be doing it again.
Elton also spoke to Oliver about his Jewish heritage.
My father is Jewish, but he's an atheist. I'm an atheist. I don't identify as Jewish. I'm half Jewish racially, whatever that means. I've no idea what race means. I think we're all 2 DNA chromosomes away from being Brussels sprouts, as far as I know. So that's how foolish racism is.
And along that extended family was Olivia Newton-John.
God, you've been doing some off-kilter research. Yes, Olivia Newton-John is my third cousin. We both are descendants of a Nobel laureate nuclear physicist called Max Born. He's her great-grandfather and he's my great-granduncle.
Ben Elton with Oliver on Wednesday. The Nobel Prize also came up on the Brendan O'Connor programme hosted last weekend by Áine Kerr. In to speak about his new book, The Hideaway, was author Dermot Bulger.
At the age of 12, I dreamt of the Nobel Prize. And then, you know, in later years, I dreamt of the Booker Prize. And now I'm at an age where I can see this glistening prize on the horizons, and it's called a free travel pass. And I get it in February.
Congratulations.
It's 50 years since my first poem was published. I'm only 65, but at 15, I was being published in the national newspapers. When I was 16, 49 years ago, my great friend Paul Dawkin was urging me on stage in the Player Will's Theatre to give my first public reading at the launch of some anthology we were both in. So for that 50 years, every day I've got up and thought about writing. I stopped walking at the age of 24 and I've managed to raise a family on the thin sliver of my imagination. I think there comes a time when you say, I've told all the stories. Now, the thing is that as a writer, you get ambushed by stories and you get ambushed by voices. But at the moment, if I walk out of the RTÉ studios and I'm run over by a 46A on the road outside, there's no story that I felt I haven't told. I felt this, dealing with the Civil War and dealing with Grange Garmon, were these two areas of Irish life that I'd never explored and I wanted to explore. So I suspect that I would be sitting quietly in Griffith Park in Dunkondra writing a poem and I'd be mugged by a novel in 2 years' time. But at the moment, I just feel I have this. It's 15 novels. I have a new play opening next week, which is my 18th play. I've written 11 books of poetry and maybe the world is saying to me, Dermot, please shut up.
Bulger's latest book is called Hideaway. It's based around the Grange Garmon area of Dublin City. Now, a cool college, but one time, something very different indeed.
Grange Garmon was the first of these hospitals, but then they sprang all over Ireland, Ballinasloe Sloan, all these places. And in 1900, one in every 200 Irish people was living in an asylum. The women were put in for things like domestic disagreements, bad treatment by relatives, jealousy, pride. And basically what they put in for, in a lot of cases, there was an unmarried sister who was in the way. This happens in Hideaway. And basically there was nowhere else to put her. And so it was where we locked away many of our secrets.
Author Dermot Bulger with Áine Kerr at the weekend. Another author with Áine was Colm McCann. He spoke of his encounters with the people who will be deciding a certain election in about a month's time.
Do you guys watch television? And no, there's no television watching going on, certainly not of the major news stations. And do you read newspapers? No, I'm not reading the newspapers, but I'm getting all my news through these various social media sites. And I have to respect that. And yet I wonder what's going on. And when I dig a little bit deeper, some of them tell me some of the most, outrageous things about these, conspiracies, that 9/11 was a conspiracy and so on. These are smart, interested people. It's not like they're completely marginalised.
And they represent almost half the country. When you're engaging with them, are they equally asking questions of you and whether you can believe all you read and hear and see?
My wife teaches in a public school in New York, and now there are a lot of immigrants there, particularly coming from South America. She teaches English as a second language. The men I talk to in Connecticut and in parts of Pennsylvania and in other parts of the country, they seem to think that New York is completely overrun and that there's a really wild mentality going on. Whereas, if you talk with my wife or if you live here in the city, you will see that it's really fairly ordered and surely, yes, there are some good things not going on. But people tend to take a tiny photograph and blow it up into a portrait of a world that doesn't actually exist. And this is part of the danger. And I think we're not really listening to one another. And I think that Trump is tapping into an American anxiety about all of that stuff. Facts can be mercenary things. They can be packed off to whatever like little orphanage you want them to go to. You can use a fact in all sorts of ways, but the texture has been lost. The real questions about, deeply human emotions, that's sort of been lost in this sort of these facts that get used and misused. And so it's fascinating to think, we're in the quote unquote post-truth era. Well, what is the real truth and where is it going to come from? The most effective way to destroy debate is to not give them a chance to speak. And part of the problem is that the people aren't speaking to one another and people aren't listening to one another. I'm in favor of the phrase, I don't know. People should be saying, well, I'm confused. I'm confused about what's going on. Let's talk about it. Let's debate it.
Colin McCann there with Áine Kerr on the Brendan O'Connor programme at the weekend. Also at the weekend, a special live Sunday miscellany. One of the pieces was called Carnegie and Me by Angela Flannery. She was born within sight of a library in Waterford. She spent her youth as a customer of a mobile library in Kilkenny.
The millennium turns and you move back to Dublin, where your local library is a neo-Georgian pile with a teak stairway and a William Morris stained glass window on the return. And a story takes root. A story about a girl who dreams of becoming an artist, a dream she knows is way beyond her station. But she doesn't stop. She keeps drawing and painting until one day somebody, a teacher, notices and tells her she must not stop. Sitting in a sunlit nook of Rathmines Library, you start to write her story. And she lives beyond the amusements in the seaside town of Tremor.
And now she's a published author.
Yours is the most borrowed book in the county. You're invited to speak there on your birthday. It's the first time you've been in the grand limestone building on Lady Lane, and you wonder how many times you must have walked past it as a little girl without ever knowing what was going on inside.
That's author Angela Flannery, whose piece Carnegie and Me featured in Sunday Miscellany from the Oris. This week, Ray followed the Odyssey of the Odyssey, a cruise ship waiting to embark on a 15-year world cruise, which had a four-month delay in Belfast. On Monday, Ray spoke to Angie, an American who bought a cabin to live on the ship.
My sister and I actually first heard about this about a year and a half ago. We started talking pretty serious about just selling everything and getting rid of the majority of our belongings and living on board and sailing the world for the next probably up to 15 years.
15 years. I just have to say that in case people go, did I miss her? Did she say 15 years? She said 15 years. It was been refitted by Harland & Wolff in Belfast. The plan was for it to leave around May.
Yes, May 30th.
May 30th.
30th was our original launch date.
Right. Okay. And then it became obvious that the ship wasn't ready.
The unfortunate part was that the ship is 30 years old and it needed to now be recertified as a brand new ship. Ran into a lot of complications with bringing an older ship up to current standards and certifications.
Yeah.
But they absolutely achieved that in, I believe, a remarkable amount of time. I know everyone was ready to go in May.
So a little group of you became friends. And one of this group was a man called Jan Peroni.
Jan, he's a Canadian that's lived in Costa Rica for the last 6 years.
Right.
He was really ready for a big change in his life as well, just kind of tired of the same old, same old. So I'm glad that our kind of visions aligned on the same cruise.
You were walking in and out to Belfast, was it? What were the chats like?
Oh, the chats went from just getting to know each other to much deeper chats, a little bit about our values and our lifelong goals and dreams and just kind of what kind of people we were. And they just grew more and more every time we went on. It was about an hour one way to the ship and back. We definitely got to know each other at a much deeper level through those talks. Through this process of getting to know each other, we actually fell in love and we got engaged.
Right.
So they sailed off into the sunset. Well, not really. A bit more the Irish Rover than the Odyssey, unfortunately. On Tuesday, the boat hit a snag.
So what have you heard from the people, Angie? What's going on?
We have just heard that we were told yesterday before we left that they had a little bit more of an administrative paperwork to complete today. So we anticipate either tonight or tomorrow morning that we will have that wrapped up and we should be out sailing the seas.
But on Thursday, just as Ray and the gang were wondering what was happening with the cruise ship, some breaking news.
Good afternoon, Angie.
Good afternoon.
Oh, right. Well, you're booming in there. What's the news?
Oh my gosh. We just sounded the horns and lifted the anchor and we are off.
Yay!
Officially. And now we are out to sea.
Yay!
Yay, we are. Yay! There you go.
There you go.
Ray and Angie throughout the week on the Ray Darcy Show. I wonder if concertina player Cormac Begley knows the Sailor's Hornpipe. He certainly knows O'Neill's March, otherwise known as Marcia O'Neill, otherwise known as Jarrag Doom. It was one of the pieces of music from the aforementioned Sunday Miscellany at the Oris, and it's going to take us up to the break. Back in a few minutes. Thank you. Welcome back. Some sad news in the world of music started off the week. The death of Texan troubadour Kris Kristofferson. Much of Liveline, with Colm O'Mungon, was taken up with tributes. Here's Kristofferson's honorary ambassador in Ireland, Gloria.
And this beautiful lady came up and asked me would I like to sing a song she wrote. And she had a co-writer. He says, I don't know about that. Nice. I have a lot of songs to learn, really, which Maura says, no, I think you'll like it. She took me out to her home and into the thing. She said, would you like to meet Chris? Well, he was sitting there in all his glory. And, well, he's such a humble man. And I think he gave a whole definition to the word aura. 10 minutes we did it, Colm, and that was the end.
A bit of a one-take wonder, was it?
Oh, yeah, yes. Yeah.
Frank Buckley was driving a minibus from the airport with Kristofferson's band. The singer turned down the delights of a limo and hopped in with the rest of the crew.
Even when we were coming down from the airport and he seen the kids on the horses, you know, he was asking about them, you know. He was saying that, you know, he had a love for horses and that, you know. And he said, well, why not? Why don't they educate them? And I said, ah, Chris, welcome to Ireland type of thing, you know. And we got into this conversation about a project that he was involved with in the States. Is there anything like that? And I said, no, there's not. And he says, well, sell one up.
Did he give you a few quid to help you on the way?
No, but he gave me his name to put to it.
Karina Malloy went to a gig with Johnny Cash and Kris Kristofferson.
I got to walk up to the stage and shake Johnny Cash's hand and Kris Kristofferson's hand in Brick for the Border. I was supposed to go with my roommate, but we had a row a few days beforehand and she refused to come with me. Thinking back now, it was just incredible to get so close to them both.
Frank Greeley also had some close encounters of the Kristofferson kind.
The first time it was a typical Irish situation. I knew a man who knew a man. He was doing a sound check and he went through a number of his songs nearly the whole way through them. And then he sat down with us for about a half an hour and he was into running. And I involved in the Irish Runner magazine. He loved talking about running. And he loved talking about boxing. He fought Golden Gloves in America. I went to college in Johnson City in East Tennessee, and he had played there once. But I really wanted to meet him that time, but security was too much. I didn't know a man who knew a man over there.
This is Fiona Prine, widow of the great John Prine.
John always credited Chris with giving John a career. John was writing songs on his mail route, and one night he'd gotten up and sang some at a local bar in West Chicago, and the owner of the bar said, I'll give you a job 5 nights a week if you have more songs. And so he was very happy doing that. He was making a lot more money than he did at the post office. And he was John was very close with another great Chicago songwriter called Steve Goodman. But Steve had been given the opportunity to open for Kris Kristofferson. Steve just kept bending Chris's ear, like every night saying, if you think I'm good, you have to hear my buddy. You've got to come hear my buddy. And so John had finished playing one night at the bar, and next thing walked in the door was Steve Goodman with Kris Kristofferson and a couple of the guys from the band. Chris asked him to sing some songs for him, and he sang Hello in There and Donald and Lydia and Angel of Montgomery and Souvenirs and all of these classic songs. And then Chris said, would you mind singing all of those again? I think he wanted to be sure that what he was hearing was real. So he sang them again, and Chris was just blown away. You know, a month or two goes by, and John and Steve Goodman were being brought to New York to play a showcase. John bought all of the local newspapers, the New York papers, saw that Kristofferson was playing down at the Bitter End in the Village. And when Chris heard that John was there, he stopped the show halfway through and told the audience that they were about to hear something really special. It's a little emotional thinking about it, honestly. The place went crazy. John didn't know it, but Ahmet Herdigan from Atlantic Records was in the audience, and John was brought to the office next day at Atlantic and given a record deal.
And then a typical Irish thing happened on Liveline.
That wasn't Carina Malloy from Ardra, Donegal.
It is, yeah. No. She's on the other line there. Do you want to say hello to her?
That's my childhood friend.
Say hello to her. She's on the other line listening to you.
Carina?
Hi, Fiona. How are you?
We lived on the same road in Ardra.
That's it, Jan, and our mothers are great friends.
Yeah, there's lots of connections.
Don't you just love Liveline? Not as much, probably, as Liz Moore O'Carroll loved Kris Kristofferson.
I had two tickets for the Glass Circle from myself and my friend. I said to her, I'm going out for a smoke. And she said, oh, Liz, don't, you know. And I'm standing out there having a smoke. And the next thing I heard this voice saying, are you enjoying the show? And I said, oh, Jesus, I tell you, if I had my way, I'd pull him off that stage and he'd go home with a smile on his face. And he said to me, I'm Kris Kristofferson. And he said, would you like me to sing something for you? And I said, oh, yeah, I love that one, Jodie and the Kid. And he came back out again. And then he said, this is especially for Liz. He said, it was the best offer I've had in a long time. And he sang Jodie and the Kid for me.
Those memories of Kris Kristofferson from Liveline on Monday, with Colm sitting in for Joe. In a week when Iran is in the news for all the wrong reasons, Irishman Bernard Phelan was on the Oliver Callan show on Thursday. He was wrongly imprisoned in an Iranian jail and sentenced to 6.5 years.
Iran is the second country after China in terms of executions in the world.
Really?
Any prisoner who was going to be executed the next morning after prayers would be brought to our block. I read recently they have done so far 700 executions. But I heard there were a lot of people killed during the protests and horrible circumstances. But
these are the protesters who remind people where a young woman, she'd refused to wear a headscarf.
Yeah.
She's arrested and she dies.
That dies in under morality police.
And it sparks enormous protests.
Enormous protests.
For a time.
One of which I come across in Tabriz in the north of Iran. And you see guys being arrested on motorbikes. The police are on unmarked motorbikes and they pick up a young man and they put the young guy between the two guys in the motorbike and drive off. And you hear gunshots, except they're real gunshots.
Really?
When you're a prisoner in the West, you know when you're going to get out. You have a date. Mm-hmm. We didn't know when we were going to get out.
He then spoke about the diplomatic manoeuvrings that affected his release.
I understand the Irish sent out a team very shortly after I was arrested, to Tehran. And the French were doing most of the negotiations. We saw regularly the French ambassador would come on a consular visit to the prison. And the Irish, I understood afterwards, that they were more involved with the Iranians in negotiating. And I met the Irish ambassador to Iran, based in Ankara, Sonia McGuinness. I remember on the 1st of May, I'll never forget that meeting. She had a wonderful smile when I went brought into the room with the guard, and she rushes up to me and hugs me, and the guard is flabbergasted because men and women can't touch each other in Iran if they're not family.
I see.
And she gives me a big hug and we got chatting, and I said to Sonia, I said, listen, I can't take much more of this. Everybody's telling us to keep quiet. The French are telling us to stay quiet. Don't upset the Iranians. The Irish said, don't upset the Iranians. I said, I'm going to upset them. I'm giving you till the 15th of May. And it's going to be a lot of trouble. Mm-hmm. And I was released on the 11th.
That day of the release?
Yes, because it was an amazing day. But we were taken down to security. We didn't know anything. And we're taken to the director of security. And he sits down. He says, you're going to be released today. And he says, you'll have to write a letter saying that you will be not attack the Iranian state or the prison for mistreatment. Mm. And both of us, without talking to each other, said, no, we're not going to write that letter. He said, okay, go back to your cells.
A crushing day. So you were worried that maybe
what was going to happen?
It can be reversed.
Yeah.
But you do finally get home and your husband, your sister, your family. I mean, it's just incredible. It must be the most incredible moment that you will
most incredible moment of my life. I mean, coming down the steps of that plane and hearing Roland shouting, Mon Bernard, my Bernard. It's my sister. It's just so wonderful. It's
gets you still.
Yeah, it gets me still.
Bernard Phelan there with Oliver on Thursday.
Earlier in the week, James Patrice, social media sensation and influencer, was a guest with Claire. In a revealing chat, they shared meningitis memories.
It was the 3rd of January, so, and I was at home and I literally just got a bit of a tummy bug. I'd had probably 74 selection boxes in the last week and I thought, oh, I don't feel too good. And my mum said, you know, but tonight get into the bed with your father and I and we'll just keep an eye on you. I said, no problem. And then about 5 or 6 a.m. I woke up. I said, okay, this is it. I need to get sick. Went into the bathroom and then my mum popped in to check on me and she saw on my legs red dots.
Ooh,
starting to appear.
Very bad and sign, isn't it?
It's kind of the number one. The thing about meningitis, of course, you can have all the symptoms, you can have none of the symptoms.
Did you have a headache?
No.
That's extraordinary, no, isn't it? Because it is the inflammation of the lining of the brain. Well, see, I know all this because I went through the same thing when I was 14.
I know, Claire. I couldn't believe it when the foundation told me. That's, we're sisters.
We are. We're sisters in pain, right?
We are, yes, yes. But someone saw the red dots on my leg and she said, oh. At the time, our local GP, he's Dr. Padiachi, he lived near us. We started banging his door down at 6 a.m. and he came down, he looked and he said, oh, that's meningitis.
Were you conscious at this stage?
I was in and out. Mm. And the doctor said, go straight into Temple Street, don't get an ambulance because there's no time. I was lying in the bed, they were cutting my clothes off. How many fingers are we holding up, James? Then I kind of passed out again, woke up in basically essentially a glass box, really.
Did you have a lumbar puncture?
I did.
Not pleasant.
Yeah. Oh, they're horrible there. Mm. You have one?
I was out for that. I was unconscious for that, thankfully. So how close to death were you? Do you know?
They told my parents, when I got in there, they said the 48 hours are critical. That was after the 2 days. When I did make it through, I was 10 days in hospital in total. For a while, I think I felt maybe guilt even. God, I put them through that, you know. But I didn't put them through that. I know that. But it's weird because every year, even on the 4th of January, we...
Oh, James.
Sorry, there.
No, take your time. You're fine. You're fine.
Mortifying, sorry.
No, I completely understand it. You know, and I'm the same. The 24th of January, you know, always comes up in my house. And it's very difficult for my mother to talk about it because it's really hard to be told that your child is in that much danger.
Very
you know?
Much so. So we always have a little celebration.
You mark the day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
James Patrice, social media sensation and influencer with Claire. The hospitality sector had a pretty bad week. In Cork, probably Munster's most famous chipper, announced they were closing. Here's Brian Lennox.
There's loads of celebrities and loads of people, but I mean, the most famous person is the next customer. We've served the people of Ireland, Cork and the world with the best we could offer. We go down proudly and ask you, please, to remember us fondly.
And the Irish Independent's Ralph Regal, in whose product Manny's the Fish and Chips was wrapped, I'm sure, was also on hand.
The famous story in Cork is that probably the best stand-up comedy was the queue at Lennox's, that, you know, it was entertainment. Famously, if there was children in the queue, there'd always be a couple of chips on a fork handed out to the youngsters. Generations of Corkonians were brought up through the wonderful food at Lennox's. And generations of students, of course, it's on Bandon Road. It's not a million miles from University College Cork. And even a lot of MTU students would kind of live in the area. You know, they'd be broke. They'd go up. They might only be able to afford a burger or a chip, but there'd always be a shovel of chips thrown into the bag with them.
Ralph Regal there on Tuesday's Morning Ireland. And before him, Brian Lennox. Some more Southern voices now from the Dock on One. First Consignment told the story of the first arms shipment from Libya to Ireland. You can still catch it on the Dock on One app. And part two is on at 2 o'clock today. Here's the flavour.
We had to strip out the interior of the plane to accommodate the shipment. We had to load 25 RPG-7 launchers and 496 warheads, which weighed 2.5 tonnes.
This was the largest weapon consignment the IRA had ever gotten hold of. It was all new to them, as Des Long explained.
The Libyans who helped load it had a big bet to know. Would they be able to take off? Could they take off? Would the plane crash? We were amateurs, I suppose, at this kind of thing. But you learn, you do your learning on the job.
Des Long also remembers exactly what was in that first consignment, including the breakdown of the 496 warheads.
There was 120 were high explosive and the others were heat to generate fire.
Everything was about getting this first consignment of weapons back home to Kerry.
The pilot, Isaac, had no problem with the takeoff. We then set off for Ireland, where I arranged with Tom O'Sullivan, the Munster Command OC, to take over Farnforth Airport, where we intended to land. Transport and people to unload were to be on hand, and the unloading and removal of the pre-arranged dumps.
From Saturday's Dock on One, called First Consignment. Over on drive time, they were concerned with WhatsApp groups. The manners of staying in or getting out. When and when not to send a voice note. Much mirth ensued.
I can be very cranky in WhatsApp groups. Family WhatsApp
really?
Groups. Yeah, yeah.
Could never imagine that.
Well, I think especially with family, hopefully not in the work WhatsApp
group. Of
course
not.
But with family, I just like, I don't like the over and back. Just cut to the chase. And if you want something, just say it. That's the way. Sarah sent me a WhatsApp voice note.
Yeah, they get away from me, don't they?
It was, my God, it was so long.
I just have so many thoughts, you know, and it just keeps going and going. It. But yeah.
Delete.
Okay.
Cormac and Sarah and the WhatsApp conundrum. On today, the hero ingredient was garlic. Brian McDermott had the place stuffed with the gorgeous cloves.
What do you have at home? Is it fresh? Is it a squeezy tube?
I would normally use fresh.
Okay.
To be fair to me. Mm. But see that squeezy tube you have in your hand?
Yeah.
I sometimes use that if I'm feeling particularly
under
pressure.
So that's the lazy garlic?
Yeah.
How much garlic do you think is in it percentage-wise?
I don't know. I've no idea. I just put about a teaspoon in or maybe a bit more.
So you're typically around about 80 to 86% garlic only.
Okay.
You've got lots and lots of other little nasties in there to preserve it, to keep it going. So that's a nice point to start on because I just want to kind of remind people of that. And they say, like you, oh, I'll just squeeze it in. It's nice and it's handy. We didn't mention roasting garlic, but it's simple. You take your full, like I have here, which is my full bulb, which contains about 10 or 11 cloves of a hardneck, larger clove, cut it in half, sprinkle some olive oil over it. If you want a little pinch of sea salt, wrap it in tin foil, into the oven, put it in alongside the roast, 30 minutes, let it cool in there, take the tin foil out, squeeze it out, and again, that mashes and purees instantly and will keep in your fridge for about a week.
Chef Brian McDermott on Today with Claire. Now, would you take career advice from Fran in Love Hate? Actor Peter Coonan made a lot of sense.
Love listening to Peter says this text. Any advice for my son who's graduated from the Gaiety School of Acting after 2 years, asks Viv.
Just keep doing what you're doing. But I did, someone asked me recently about for advice for a young actor who was coming out of school and they wanted to get into a course that they didn't get into. And at the time, it was a former teacher of mine. And I said, do you know what wouldn't be a bad idea for actors would be to get a trade. Do you know? If I was going back, I'd learn a trade. I'd become a sparks or a carpenter or a plumber. And then I'd go out into the acting world. Keep watching acting.
Spark is a nice, clean job. Yeah. Well paid.
And keep watching films. Keep going to theatre. Keep reading plays with your friends. Keep that alive. But then when you're 21, 22, you have this job that you can do anywhere in the world.
And speaking of sometimes precarious jobs, musician Derek Farrell was Ray's guest on Tuesday.
I do know this. I've worked at a lot of different jobs, right? To be honest with you, like, do you know what I mean? I've got a bit of life experience in behind me before I started playing music even. So I do understand what a hard job is. And playing music is, for me, it isn't a hard job. It's an absolute pleasure. I really mean that.
And you love it,
I'll sing a song for you called The Point of Playing. It started out life as a poem. You probably know that it's a fairly famous poem, but there was a chorus and music put to it by a friend of ours called Pat Good, who was an absolute legend.
Eamon Morrissey used to do A Point of Playing.
This is the song version of it, anyway. And if you want to sing along, it's A Point of Playing. It's your only man, A Point of Playing is your only man.
Derry Farrell from the Ray D'Arcy programme on Tuesday. And that brings my playback to an end. From me, Brian Lally, bye-bye, and thanks a million for listening.
When things go wrong but will not go right, though you do the best you can, and when life seems dark as the hour of night, a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man. And when times are trouble and lousy strife, though you still have a darling plan, you can always turn to a better life, for a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. well, a pint of plain is your only man. And when your health is bad and your heart feels strange and your face is pale and wan, oh, and the doctor says you need a change, a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man. And when hunger's there and your barter's bare and no rashers grease your pan, oh, and your hunger grows because your meals are rare, well, a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man. And in times of trouble and lousy strife, though you still have a darling plan, you can always turn to a better life, for a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man. It's your only man, your only man. Well, a pint of plain is your only man.